Yeah, it's not that funny.
Oh, even better. Okay.
Wow. Yeah, way to set up expectations.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. And, hey, no, Mickey, you'd be amazing at stand-up.
I'm more of a sit-down type of person.
I've got this gag, but it's not funny. Here it comes.
Okay. And I've already got a title for this episode.
Oh?
Lounge of the Apes.
It's not cracking, but I'm fine with that.
Well, it's a lounge. It's not supposed to crack.
What's the phrase? It's nice.
Not thrilling,
but nice.
It's got a great personality.
Yeah.
Planet of the Apes. I wonder if there's something for me to talk about. Okay.
We'll see. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the gentlemen nerds. The gentlemen nerds are four entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about geeky and nerdy things, mostly in the vein of film, television, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many, many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemennerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Lobot Lounge. We are gathered here together once again around our table to discuss the Planet of the Apes series. We are very excited about this episode because the Planet of the Apes is a cultural phenomenon since the original film was released in 68. And now we've got all these remakes and reboots, and we are in the middle of this great reboot series with Andy Serkis portraying Caesar. And now we have the brand new film about to come out, War for the Planet of the Apes. And boy, I tell you, it's a thrill. It is a thrill because I absolutely love this series. Gathered at the table, as always, to discuss all things ape, we have Aaron DiArrive.
Ape shall never kill ape.
Mickey Finn.
Aaron took mine.
And the man of the hour, the one that we're going to celebrate as well as the apes, the ape himself, Mr. Mark Finn.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
Yes, and I'm Joseph Botinos, your host and emotional touchstone. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge and this episode of The Gentleman Nerds. Now, Mark, you must be bouncing off the walls, man. You must be in ape heaven, as it were.
I could not be happier, mostly because this was one of the series that is real near and dear to me growing up as a kid. I hit the sort of the trifecta of gorilla movies and ape culture in the 70s when all this stuff was being replayed ad nauseum on cable, or not cable, but at the time, local television stations as part of their syndication packages.
Oh yeah.
So there wasn't a summer that didn't go by that I didn't turn out for Going Ape Week on Channel 8 in Dallas. You know, King Kong was in regular rotation. You know, the good Kong, the real Kong. And so for me, this stuff cleaves very deeply and hits me very emotionally in terms of nostalgia. But also, as I got older, I grew into the themes. You know, it stopped being gorillas on horseback, how cool, and became, wait a minute, this is a metaphor for race relations and so much more, you know. And so what I'm most thrilled about is that this new series has managed to retain everything that was great about the initial series in terms of that spectacle and wonder, but has completely changed and updated the themes to make them more relevant to now without going into a sort of a pastiche remake.
Yeah.
We saw it happen when Burton did it.
And
it's a textbook example of why you shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
You know,
I will always love the Tim Burton version for Helena Bonham Carter behind the scenes smoking a cigarette in full makeup talking about how flammable this is and she shouldn't be doing this. But fuck it.
Well, Maurice Evans on the set of the original Planet of the Apes, there's some great footage of him smoking a cigarette with a cigarette holder through his Dr. Zaius makeup, and it looks so natural.
Yes,
for Zaius to be smoking with the cigarette holder. You know, he's just sitting there smoking and just having a, you know, just looking so dapper as Dr. Zaius.
I love that the orangutans. That's the one thing again. They got everything wrong, but oh my god, the orangutan looked amazing in that one dinner scene, played by the actor that Tim Burton always gets. He played Otho in Beetlejuice. I forget the gentleman's name, but wow, I will always love the original Planet of the Apes movies. They're fantastic, exactly. But I mean, the way the apes, they were so distinguishable one from another. The gorillas looked very different and moved in a certain way. The chimps looked, you know, especially as played by Tim Roth, were much more sinister. And the orangutans were amazing. It looked like a big, huge orangutan sort of walking through the space, waddled like the orangutans do. It was great. The makeup effects were fantastic.
It's a shame because Rick Baker was the one that designed all that. And Rick Baker was a protege of Dick Smith, who was friends with Robert W. Chambers, who was the guy that created the original ape makeup. And so and Rick Baker is a gorilla man, too. He's designed probably more modern gorilla suits than anybody. Yeah. So if there was anybody to get for this movie, it was him. And it's a shame because he did such a great job of retaining the practical makeup effects that were so integral to the original series.
Yeah,
and those beautiful makeups were absolutely wasted on the production. That's the problem. Is that everybody want if I'm digging through the trash that is that remake, the one thing I'll fish out of it and hold it aloft with two fingers and a thumb is Rick Baker's design work, which was sensational. It is the gem in that terrible, terrible turd salad.
The standout for me would be that moment where Tim Roth visits a dying Charlton Heston in heavy ape makeup and gets a gun from Charlton Heston. Yeah, I just found that incredibly funny. I mean, it wasn't intended to be, but I was in the theater laughing, going, "Oh my God, is Heston going to give him a gun? He's going to give him a gun."
Yeah, he gives him a gun. Why not? Yeah,
you know, that changed the balance of power. I mean, gun violence, contemporary wars, urban decay, all that was on display in that remake. But I also really, while I do love the makeup, I love the physicality that Aaron was talking about. There was that scene where they're running. And the apes are running on all fours, and they're running faster than the horses. I mean, they are moving. There's that battle scene where they're all running across the landscape, but it's very impressive.
There was certainly some, absolutely. And you know what's nice about these new movies is that the digital stuff that Weta Workshop has put together has continued to improve off of the Lord of the Rings trilogy and Gollum, to the point now that these guys are all working. They are all actors on set. It's actors in space utilizing the space between, you know, themselves. You know, it's Caesar and Andy Serkis, in the same room with Woody Harrelson, which is fantastic. But they've got it down to such a point that you forget that you're looking at things that aren't real, you know. excuse me. And moreover, they've all of the actors who are playing these roles have been outfitted with arm extensions and padding so that they have been trained to walk a certain way and move a certain way. And you get essentially the same type of performance that you're getting in the remake that Burton did, but you're getting it on a much more sophisticated makeup, and it's a more sophisticated makeup than Baker was able to come up with because it utilizes more of the actor's face.
It's interesting to me that you call it makeup though, because it's not somebody sitting in a chair getting made up. It right. is. It's digital.
It's but I, yeah.
But you I still refer it as, to it as makeup.
We've reached think, the point I where think this think is digital makeup.
I think of it as digital makeup, and that's probably, you know, not the term they would use. I know they're you know, it's motion capture and all that sort of thing. But in essence, it's a digital mask that is
worn. You're right. I just think that there's a distinction to be made between someone who works in putty and grease paint and latex and paint and skills with the hands, you know, to create a makeup. I think that makeup union would be very upset at you right now.
But
on the other hand, it says something for the mocap and LiDAR artists that mm-hmm. we can actually talk about it as virtual digital makeup rather than CGI.
Yeah.
It is
yeah, because
CGI,
there is a person there. There is a person
from a poetic
there,
yeah. angle, it says mm-hmm. something that we've reached the point where you can do that.
I'm still torn. I'm on the fence for it. I think that it's a gorgeous, beautiful thing to look at. And my God, does it look good? You know, I'm all about it. But I want to make, for me, it's a very important distinction for practical effects to go, that's an amazing practical effect. Yes. And that belongs right. in this category. And that's a digital effect. It yes, belongs right. in
that
another category.
That hasn't changed.
And never the twain shall meet. Yeah, I never consider digital
changed.
Effect to be makeup.
It's just,
okay.
it's just that we've reached the point where we can call it virtual makeup or digital makeup.
You can call it digital virtual makeup. I refuse to do so. Makeup is a box that Lon Chaney had full of putty and grease paint and color. And things like that. That's
foam
makeup.
Foam latex. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I take your point. I do. For me, and I think we all agree here, anything that gets us over that hump into the arena of a willing suspension of disbelief.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is fair game. And so in this case, I think it was more practical for them mm-hmm. to go this route.
To not use practical effects.
Yeah, well, I think it was a more practical consideration because Andy Serkis basically set the pace by being able to do a digitally rendered character in real time and real space. I mean, this is the same technique that we've been talking about it all year with Rocket Raccoon and other things of that nature. So it's not, you know, this is kind of where we are now, and that's not to say that practical effects are going to ever go away completely. There is a strong, it's not a resurgence like vinyl, you know what I mean? but there are times when practical effects make more sense.
Like Star Wars.
And they look better in many cases. You get down to the nitty gritty of it and you have a real time actor on set and stage and then you go, oh my God, look at that. Look what they did. Look what they created. You know, his head's not going to fly off his body and jump around the room. That's digital. But look at the skill involved in making that face and making that character. And then the actor, of course, working through that makeup is a skill, not because they're putting digital magic on him and there are dots on his face. He's still the actor. But when you put latex and layers of latex, and I'm going to jump back to John Chambers in the original Planet of the Apes makeups. That was huge. That was groundbreaking. That was stunning.
It was a quantum leap forward. Absolutely.
It was. I think he won an Oscar for his makeup.
It was the first. They invented an Oscar for him.
Yeah.
Essentially, he was the first guy to get a special effects Oscar. Yeah. It was actually for special makeup techniques.
That's right.
And
that's
so that was a significant thing that they basically came up with a category to reward him for that. Mm-hmm. That's not something the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is usually not that forward thinking. So the fact that they came up with that in 69 to give it to him is significant. Yeah.
But working through those makeups, I mean, your actors, your Kim Hunters, your Roddy McDowells, your Maurice Evans, you know, it takes some doing. And I remember an interview with Roddy where he was talking, because Roddy McDowell and Harris, ladies and gentlemen, played the original Cornelius in Planet of the Apes and then Caesar in the remaining parts of the series and then in Galen in the TV show. Yeah, he was very much the guy, right? And he was always talking about how he had to exaggerate his facial features and I'm making the face now. You guys can't see me, but you know, to move your cheeks and your nose and your eyes, and when you're talking, everything has to move. Your jaw moves back and forth to make that makeup come alive, to make it look like flesh. You know, and he was very good at it. I mean, his expressions as Cornelius / Caesar / Galen, you know, his little head tilt and his oh, and he'd have that jaw motion going on where that lower jaw was jutting out, and he was so good at it, you know.
Yeah, he and Hunter too.
Oh yeah,
she really had the most expressive face, and especially when she smiled. Or when she was happy, it really came through in the makeup.
She
really
did. In fact, isn't there, I could have sworn, maybe I'm making this up, but I could have sworn I saw a special where they were talking about how the expression would come through in the makeup. And as they were putting Kim Hunter's makeup on, she was trying to sort of smile or grin to see what effect it would have on her makeup, on her face, to show if Zero was happy or amused, or because she had a very specific way that she smiled. She'd wrinkle her nose and sort of shake her head and then pull back at the corners of the makeup.
Right.
So you could see her really, really. It was an exaggerated smile, but it really worked for her.
Yeah.
So I think the actors were looking for, all right, I've got all this stuff on. How does a performance come through? How do I still show that I'm happy or sad or scared or whatever it is?
Yeah. And sidebar,
they did an amazing job.
As a sidebar, there's a show on the Sci-Fi Channel called Face Off that's in its like umpteenth season. Where they have special effects makeup artists, up and coming, fresh, occasionally a cake decorator for some reason. But hey, a cake decorator won the entire season one time. And one of the things the judges, who are all major people in effects, one of the things the judges always look for is how well the face can move and emote inside the makeup, so it's not just a mask.
The actor's performance is always of critical importance. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to go ahead and take a step back for our listeners, because we just sort of jumped in with all four of our ape paws and leapt into this. I really want to kind of cover the original Planet of the Apes and quickly go through, I think, the series to get us to where we are now.
Sure.
With Pierre Bouillon's novel in 1963, which was different, vastly different. And it took a rewrite of the original story, because in the original story, and help me out here, Mark, it was not Earth in the future. It was just another planet.
That's right.
Where humans were mute and the apes were in charge. And so, but when they put it out on 20th Century Fox, when they started to produce it, they hired no one other than Rod Serling himself to rewrite this script, or help them write this script. And it was Serling who decided that the themes would be, and he loves these themes, you know, racism and religious prejudice. And of course, he did the sci-fi twist, and we rediscover, spoiler alert, that it's actually Earth in the future.
Is that what that meant with the Statue of Liberty?
Yep.
Wow.
Oh, you know what? Sidebar. I showed my son the original Planet of the Apes years ago. I said, you're going to love this movie. You know, I think must have been 8. And I said, you're going to love this movie. So we go to the video store, because I didn't own it. So we went to the video store to rent it. Yes, I know video stores. And the box art shows the Statue of Liberty in the beach.
And I'm like, it gives it away, yeah.
What the hell? Who approved that? Yep. I mean, it's an iconic image, but it's also a shocking image. It's supposed to shock you at the end of this movie, you know? Yep. But here it is. Guess what, everybody?
Spoilers weren't a concept back then.
They figured that, you know, it being the 30th anniversary, if you, you know, or 25th at the time, if you were new to this, you know, you probably already knew anyways. I mean, Simpsons had already done at least two Planet of the Apes jokes that I could think of. So, but anyways, when Serling got into it, he brought the nuclear Holocaust angle up and did something else too. He made Taylor a cynic.
Oh, he was an ass.
Yeah, he was a real ass. You know, it's almost like, you know, how did you get this job, Taylor? You know
what? I think they wanted him off the planet. I think he was like, you know, let's get George Taylor off this planet because he's an a-hole.
It didn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, right?
He came back and eventually blew the place up again.
Right? But he learned humanity through apes. He learned how to be a human being because he was treated like an animal. Isn't that great?
Yes.
Good God.
Yeah, it's great because he does have a transformation, not a change of heart, but certainly a change of perspective.
Right.
And some of the best lines in the movie, are the conversations between him and Dr. Zaius.
Oh yeah. Love those scenes.
Great stuff. You know, Doctor, you've hated me ever since you first met me, and I have no idea why.
Yes. You know, I hated you and feared you because I know.
Maurice
Evans nails it too. I mean, everybody, and nothing against Rodney McDowell, who literally props up the Ape series.
Right.
But Dr. Zaius as character.
Well, his title was the Minister of Science and Theology.
Together.
Which, by the way, again, and when you think about it, has a lot of resonance today, doesn't it?
Oh, totally. That's what's nice about these movies. The original series is the gift that keeps on giving. So the first movie came out, and it had a modest budget, but it was one of those movies, like so many others, like The Matrix and some of these other more recent movies, where the executives had no idea what they were getting. They didn't get it. They didn't understand it. They'd look at the script and they'd be like, "It's talking monkeys. What are we doing? Is it Lancelot Link, Secret Chimp? What's going on?" They didn't really know until they saw it, you know. And by then, it had come out and become this sort of cultural thing. People, you know, responded to it in a very visceral way back then. Mostly because of the messages inherent in the changes in the script. Pierre, by the way, hated the movie. You know, he hated the adaptation of it. He thought it was, yeah, he did not care for the things that that Serling did. He felt the whole thing was ham-fisted and, you know.
Well, I mean, from my understanding, the novel was just so different. I mean, it was just like the normal world. Apes driving around in cars and going to jobs and being government officials. And, you know, it was just like the normal world. And so I'm sure from his perspective, to turn it into, you know, apes capturing these wild humans running around and in the woods, you know, and their society was very primitive. It was reductionist to a certain extent, but I think for a movie it worked. It painted in broader strokes, mm-hmm. and I think more people, because of that, more people were able to both enjoy it and grok it.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
The sci-fi element to these films was huge because we had time travel in the very beginning. When we see that Statue of Liberty, that destroyed, half-buried Statue of Liberty in the sand, I know that, and Mark, I'm sure you felt the same way, that first shot of it is haunting. There's no dramatic music. It's just the sound of the surf crashing on the beach.
Yeah.
And Taylor's, and the way it ends, too, the credits are you hear the surf crashing on the beach. That's how it ends. It goes dark, and you still hear that, you know?
It's a quiet moment.
It's haunting, yeah.
Realization, you know? Yeah, I loved... As a kid, I didn't quite get it all, but I understood that it was a horrific thing, you know. And,
and by the way, so speaking of which, I got to share this quick story. We went to E3 right around, I think it was like 2000, maybe 99 or 2000. And at that time, there was a Planet of the Apes based on the original Planet of the Apes game that was being promoted and it was coming out. And they had a huge display of it, Planet of the Apes, and they had people come in with the original makeup from the original movies. Looks fantastic. Mm. And there was a Dr. Zaius character. I mean, everybody was there. It was just amazing. And one of my friends and I are walking by, and he looks up at the big, huge display that says Planet of the Apes. And he says, "Oh, look, a Planet of the Apes game." And Dr. Zaius is right there. And he says, "Wait, what was your first clue? When did you first realize that?" And my friend's like looking at him, and Zaius' character's completely in character, loved it. He's like, "I'm trying to prove that you animals can reason. So what gave it away?"
Oh, that's wonderful.
And then, you know, my friend started sort of interacting with him, and two big gorillas come walking up, you know, shuffling their shoulders, and one of them's like, "Is he giving you a problem, Dr. Zaius?" And, no, this is fine. It's an experiment. And the gorillas nod and walk off. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
I just popped Geek Wood right now. That's
and the funny thing is I can't even remember the game.
No, I think it was canceled. I think it was actually canceled. But the display was gorgeous. It was beautiful. And the guy, the makeup, I mean, they did not spare money on this display. And they hired professional actors to come out. And, you know, Zaius sounded like Zaius, looked like Zaius.
Genius.
Yeah.
It actually turns out that wasn't actually Zaius. That was just Brian Blessed hanging around. Maybe.
Without makeup.
Yeah. Yes, exactly, and he still looked like Zaius. It's amazing.
But no, that character too, Zaius, is one of those characters that, you know, while he's kind of the villain of the movie, there's also a level of respect that you have for him because he does admit completely what's going on, you know. And by the time it's over, we realize, you know, that this is a madhouse and it's a twisted upside down world, but it's the world that we created, and that we get that at the end, of course.
Yeah, and the irony is that Zaius, who has been sort of the bad guy for this whole thing, is not wrong.
That's right, exactly right. He's trying to defend ape society. He's trying to defend it, you know. We'll cover some more about the lawgiver and the rules later, but I want to move.
He's echoed in the third movie, by the way, but we have to get to the second movie first.
Yes. So anyway, the original Planet of the Apes, gigantic hit. Of course, sequels immediately started. The next one, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which, while not as good as the original, is still my second favorite in the series. I do love that movie a lot.
How much acid have you taken?
It's great.
I love that movie. I love Beneath the Planet of the Apes. It introduces a big sci-fi element of the mutants that live underneath the planet. And because of the nuclear bomb they worship, the Alpha and Omega bomb, they're hideously deformed. They wear masks to cover their faces. And they have psionic and psychic power to inflict pain and to influence people by mind control. And it's a unique, twisted, underground society that Brett, another astronaut who followed in the same footsteps as Taylor, lands on the planet with his spaceship.
Played by James Franciscus.
James Franciscus.
Who is the guy that they would always go to when Charlton Heston was not available.
That's right. And Chuck Heston's in the movie at the beginning and at the end, basically, and he was uninterested in a sequel, but, you know, he said, okay, I'll do a couple of scenes or whatever just to kind of... And he donated his salary for that movie to charity.
For years
when I was a boy and I watched that movie, I always thought that the other Charlton Heston looking character was actually the same character, but just looping back in time. When he meets his older self, I'm like, oh, look, cool. The young Charlton Heston has met the old Charlton Heston. I did. I thought it was the same character. And it's just years later that I went, oh, it's a different. They're calling him a different name. It's a different guy.
So James the new Back to the Future was just a ripoff of Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Exactly.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
No, but I agree with Joseph. Beneath the Planet of the Apes introduces so many very cool sci-fi elements and moments with the entire underground society and their mind powers and their worship of the bomb. And I mean, it's very cool.
And here's the other thing. Creepy. It was Heston himself who supplied the ending to the movie.
That's right.
He was the one who suggested let's detonate the bomb because he did not want to come back for a third sequel. He kind of saw the writing on the wall on this. You know, the first movie made so much money that they had to have an answer could. You know, they it was open-ended enough that they could. So with Heston not wanting to continue the adventures of Taylor, they had to kind of go a different route. And so, you know, what do you do in Hollywood? Let's do the same movie again. That's kind of, you know.
But there's a unique angle on this Beneath because the apes are going to war against the mutants in the Forbidden Zone, the humans in the Forbidden Zone. Because once again, the humans are the worst thing in the world. We have to rout them out. We have to kill them. We have to destroy them. We have to get rid of them. They're a plague. You guys, I'm sorry. I've been holding this in my throat since we started this, and I just need to say it. Beware the beast man, for he is the devil's pawn. Alone among God's primates, he kills for sport, or lust, or greed. Yea, he will murder his brother to possess his brother's land. Let him not breed in great numbers, for he will make a desert of his home and yours. Shun him, drive him back into his jungle lair. For he is the harbinger of death. That's the law.
And I know where there is one mutant that is often another and another.
Oh, General Ursus. Oh, my God. General Ursus, played by James Gregory in that film, in his big speech, which, again, Aaron, you're right, very topical, sitting there riling the crowd up, you know, riling those apes up. The only good human is a dead human.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. You know, oh, and they, you know, and then the chimpanzees.
And I'm just going to say, that's the beauty. That's the beauty of what Dr. Zaius is afraid of, is that that brutality is in his midst the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, that's the ironic part, is that beware man, and here these gorillas jumping all over the bomb and destroying everything, and it's like, it's just hilarious. It's always the other guy, right? Yeah, it's always the other, it's them. It's them that are violent, not us. Yeah, we're patriots, you know.
And it's a race thing, obviously. I mean, gorillas for gorillas only, and man for man, they're animals, you know. Yep. We don't want those things.
I should mention this before we go too much further, that the casting call for extras on these movies was, of course, enormous. They needed hundreds of people in makeup, and some of the makeups in the backgrounds are a little more than a pullover mask.
Yeah.
But what they found that was interesting is that however they broke out, you know, they put people in the masks who could basically fit in the costumes, because they had gloves, they had boots, they had masks. So they were completely covered from head to toe. Yeah. What they found is, no matter who you were underneath, the gorillas clumped up with the gorillas, the apes, the chimps clumped up with the chimps, and the orangutans clumped up with the orangutans.
That's right. They were eating. Yeah.
Yeah.
They tended to go towards the type that they looked like, which I think was probably the most interesting sociological experiment of all.
Absolutely.
Was the ease with which they fell into that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so anyways.
And then on top of that was, it's even in the script. The orangutans have a low opinion of the gorillas.
Right.
Oh, well, right. But you don't really get that in the movies so much. It sort of comes out in some of the courtroom dialogue. Yeah. And certainly there's a pecking order, but you don't, there's in the book, there's a stratified ape society that's more complicated.
Right.
So
there is a form of throwaway comments from like Dr. Zaius and stuff.
There is definitely some sort of a caste system going
very
on.
Very much so.
Yes.
In their society, but
the military is the gorillas, and the orangutans are more the political leaders, and I guess the more the heads of state. The chimpanzees are the intelligent, sensitive scientists and protesters, because in beneath the Planet of the Apes, when the apes are marching to war in the Forbidden Zone, they're stopped by a bunch of Vietnam era young chimp protesters with signs who sit in the middle of the road and try to block them. I mean, it's reflective of what was going on then. It's reflective of what's going on now. Right, it's an important moment in that series.
Were the signs written in something that was incomprehensible to us, or did they use?
Hey, come on, man. Erebus was not invented in Star Wars until after Star Wars. Erebus does not exist. It was English, folks. It was English.
So the second movie was made for less money than the first one, but it grossed more money than the first one. Yeah. And, of course, they knew, even though that the planet had blown up, they had to make a third one.
They did indeed, and they moved on. By the way, real quick note on Beneath, Roddy McDowall was unavailable to play Cornelius, so another actor, David Watson, stood in for him, although Roddy McDowall did do the voiceover. It was his voice coming out, but it was a different actor. Roddy McDowall returned in harness as Cornelius in the next film, Escape from the Planet of the Apes. Now, if you blow up the planet, literally blow up the planet, how do you have another sequel, Mark?
I know. Let's have the chimps pull up Taylor's original spacecraft, get it working, and then do a Superman riff and put Zira and Cornelius in it and send them back through the time hole, back in time to when Taylor was there, because clearly they wanted to check out his story, right? So that's how you, coincidentally, in the amount of time that it took the gorillas to storm the Forbidden Zone and find Taylor and blow up the planet is exactly the same amount of time it took Zira and Cornelius to repair the spaceship and send it back through the time hole.
Yes.
Now, since I have no problem with an architecture of coincidence, because I've read Frankenstein, I feel like this is perfectly legitimate. If you buy this premise, then the rest of the movie makes perfect sense.
That's right. Yeah. And they had a third ape with him as well, but he gets killed earlier on in the film. Mind you, of course, this was one of the most successful, profitable movies in the ape series because they only had to do three ape makeups. And it was all in modern day, you know, New York, and it was absolutely easy for them to do.
With Ricardo Montalban.
Yes, at the very end when he shows up. Now let's back up a bit, because I'm a kid and I'm watching this series and my brain hurts. My mind is blown because I had to figure out, wait a minute. You do mean to tell me that Cornelius and Zira, their child, Caesar, is the one who's going to lead the revolution and take over the planet? But if they had, if Taylor hadn't have gone to the future with his spaceship, they would never have been able to come back anyway in the spaceship to have Caesar to create the planet of the apes. It's a big ending circle of a snake eating its own head. I mean, its own tail. I'm blown away. I don't understand it. How does that work? My brain was shattered, right?
Oh, it was so good though. But it's what I like about it is that it is it closes a loop. That's what's fun about these kind of movies and I don't think it was by design. I think they about halfway through is when they realized, oh, we can close the loop. And so
yeah, that had to be one of the things they stumbled into and was just one
was
of those
Rod
happy
Serling
kind
still
of
alive at that point.
He was not.
Okay.
Or he was no, actually he was probably working on Night Gallery then.
Okay.
He was alive.
He was alive. Yeah.
He was still alive.
Because there are several Twilight Zone episodes that do this.
Sure. Totally. Yeah. Anytime you start playing with time travel, you're gonna have the temptation to do that. And Serling worked every one of those iterations into Twilight Zone and Night Gallery.
I was going to say the when I was a kid also they had in the 70s growing up with Mark I had a series of Power Records of the Planet of the Apes series.
Yes. Oh,
and,
me too.
Yeah.
Sure.
So
with
I
the
remember
comic
the,
books.
Yeah, yes. I love those things. But I remember the ending of Beneath. First of all, the artwork of the mutants in Beneath was terrifying. But I remember the ending of Beneath where it shows the earth melting, the core of the earth melting. Yeah. And that I stared at that picture for hours because it freaked me out. I saw my planet being destroyed by this Alpha and Omega bomb. So the next movie, when they're back, Zira focuses on that. She says she has a line. Kim Hunter as Zira says, "We saw the Earth's core melt. No. We saw it destroy because we're leaving the planet and it's being destroyed. And we come back. You know, how just a mind." I don't want to use the word, but it's a mind screw. You know, you're just trying to have a hard time with it. It's really amazing.
I love the fact though that it also kind of cuts it off at the legs. You know, there is no going back now. You know, that place is done.
Yeah. And before we get letters, you know, from our vast audience of fans, before we get letters from the scientifically minded, yes, the Earth's core is already molten and melted. Yes.
Oh, sure. Yeah. We have to, you know,
it's a figure of speech.
Yes. Yeah.
No, we get it. We get it.
I love that the third movie.
How long after the movies reversal. Did the TV show start?
Well, let's continue down our row here because we have Escape from the Planet of the Apes. Cornelius and Zira are murdered because they are apes and they're people are terrified of the fact that they're going to have the baby that's going to change the world. They didn't even kill the baby, but a quick switcheroo puts Caesar in the care of Armando, played by Ricardo Montalban, and he escapes with the intelligent gorilla, who ends the movie saying, "Mama, mama," into the screen. A chilling ending.
And the guy that was playing the assassin character, the government agent or whoever, is the tie back that I was talking about with Dr. Zaius, because his motives are the same.
Yep.
Right. Yep. Sure.
Absolutely. But Zaius was actually a good guy, whereas this guy's just.
Zaius was a little bit of a bad guy. But I get what you're saying. Yeah. He was the president's science advisor in that film, in Conquest.
Right.
I mean, in Escape. So Conquest of the Planet of the Apes is next. Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. has Roddy McDowell signed on to play Caesar, Ricardo the Montalban, and we're now at a place where and we know this in the history of the story, according to the history of Planet of the Apes in this particular series, a virus has killed off all the dogs and all the cats. The strange virus has killed all dogs and all cats. So humans say, I want pets. So they get trained apes to be their pets.
They start domesticating chimps and gorillas and orangutans. It's crazy.
As one does.
Right. Yeah, why not? That's the logical jump. But these people will bring them coffee, change their shoes, wash their cars. The apes are doing all the manual. They're little more than slaves.
Right.
I find it telling that you said these people will bring them.
Well, because at this point, four movies in, we are completely on team.
Yes.
Caesar.
And that's what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. If you're watching the fourth movie, you're identifying completely with the ape society now. So yeah.
And there is and I think Cornelius tells the story of Caesar, again, probably not knowing that, you know, the great ape that's first said no would be his own son. But you know, because that what happens, there's a moment, and that no is so important. We're going to catch up with that no later on in the Andy Serkis series, that right. great line where he says no. And it's the same thing where an ape stands up with all my fellow apes who have been enslaved and beaten and brutalized by these people. And the ape's going to say no, you know, and that's it. And it turns. And then we have this great battle on a small scale, obviously. Hey, Mark, where was this filmed? That unique little shopping mall that it was filmed.
It was it was in California. They I can't remember. It was one of the outskirts. It's not a. It was the same place where they filmed Logan's Run.
Yeah. That very futuristic looking.
Yeah.
Concrete structures.
It was such a strange. I want to say it's in like Orange County or something like that. It's this weird. Or no, Pasadena. I think it's in Pasadena, but it's just a strange sort of.
Yeah.
I guess for them, they thought it was futuristic. You know, I was watching it as a kid, thinking it's not futuristic enough. You know, but you know, the budget for each one of these movies decreased as they went along. So.
And again, as a sidebar for those people writing and going, it was the Fort Worth Water Gardens that was just the end of Logan's Run.
Right. Yes, that's right. So Roddy McDowell plays Caesar, the son of Cornelius, in slightly altered makeup. There is a difference if you look at the makeups. They're not identical. Cornelius was a little bit paler in his skin, and for some reason Caesar's a little darker, and he's got more ridged foreheads. It's still Roddy McDowell under that. It still sounds just like Cornelius, but it's Caesar now.
I think it was a stronger makeup.
Oh, I do too. Absolutely.
Caesar. I think they're trying to give him more of a heroic cast.
Yeah. So Caesar leads the apes from bondage to rebellion. And it's very telling on the civil rights movement. You know, it's obviously reflective of that. And it's I think it's a fantastic film. I like it a lot.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Because Caesar leads the, you know, all levels of ape, gorilla, orangutan, they all fall in line.
Yeah, that's actually my second favorite in the series.
Is that right?
Yeah.
There was also a reshot ending. The original ending they thought was too dark. They were concerned that there might be a pushback from the show. The original ending was basically one of fire and revolution. Mm-hmm. And they backed it up to say, let's try and carve out a place for ourselves.
Right.
Instead. And so that's what gets us to the final ape movie, where there's this uneasy truce between the two, ape culture and human culture. And of course, by this point, unfortunately, it's the apes that start the whole situation off and running, the gorillas in specific.
Aldo, played by, what's his name?
Claude Akins.
Claude Akins, thank you, is Aldo. The evil gorilla general who follows in Ursus's footsteps, I guess. And interesting enough, the Mego action figure of Planet of the Apes, Ursus and Aldo, were pretty much the same figure. just with a different name. They basically just put the same, he had the same helmet and everything like that, that very distinctive helmet. Yeah, anyway. I used to get it mixed up all the time. So Battle for the Planet of the Apes is the final film in the original series from 73. And it does have that easy truce, but the apes kind of mess it up. There's a great opening and closing with the Lawgiver, played by John Huston.
Mm-hmm.
The Lawgiver, of course, is referred to throughout the entire series. In fact, in Beneath the Planet of the Apes, the Lawgiver statue is created as an illusion by the mutants, and it starts to bleed and burn. And it's a terrifying thing for the apes because they give it's like putting Jesus up in front of them, and Jesus starts to bleed.
Right.
The Lawgiver was a huge thing for them. But we see the Lawgiver in this film at the beginning and the end. And there's a battle. And Caesar's still there leading against who he thinks the humans are, the villains, but it's really the apes kind of starting it because of all I keep wanting to say racism. Is it racism? Is it, speciesism? What would you call that?
Well, you could certainly make an argument for genocide.
Yeah.
You know, since they're trying to kind of, each is trying to wipe out the other. Right. I think of it in terms of a frontier society. There's an academic came up with the idea of regeneration through violence as an American trait. And that what we do is that we reinvent ourselves. We go to the wilderness and establish ourselves as the normal and everything else is the other.
Yeah.
and so that's how the Indians become devils. That's how the bears become monsters. And it's not quite like that, but there is sort of the idea. Especially because of the way that they shot the village in battle, it's this kind of agrarian society, and we're on one side and they're on the other, and you know we interact as much as we have to, but it's sort of an uneasy sort of a thing, and it only takes a push to get us all going in the wrong direction. I feel like that is closer to what they were trying to do, this sort of uneasy truce. And interpretations vary on this, which is why this is kind of one of the weakest ones in the series, is it's kind of a muddied and confused idea. All the other ones, you see exactly what they're trying to say. This one, sort of not so much, you know?
Well, even the ending of it is ambiguous, where we go back to the Lawgiver and there's a statue of Caesar, and the camera pans up to the statue of Caesar after all this has happened, and it starts to cry. It sheds a single tear, which is creepy and weird. But also, what does it mean? Is he sad because all of this is for nothing and we're going to go right to the Planet of the Apes regardless? Or is it a tear because, hey, we finally beat this cycle of racism and oppression and military dominance? You know, it's ambiguous, so we don't know exactly
it's
why.
Sappy. Yeah, it's not a victory note.
It's a tree crying.
You know,
it's
sappy. Well, it's also at the time the commercial was very popular. The Indian standing on the side of the road looking at the trash.
Oh yeah.
And he would shed a tear for the fact that we're not taking care of the planet, and so there's some weird echoes in the whole thing. That's very, it's a confusing message to say the least. Which makes what came afterwards all the more interesting.
1974, Aaron, to answer your question, it was a year after the last film that it became
a
TV series.
Okay, wow. That was very quickly after.
Right in.
Right into it. And it was CBS who picked it up, and it was basically, we're back to the Planet of the Apes. We've got Alan and Peter, these two astronauts, 20th century astronauts, who go through a time warp and land in a planet where apes evolved and humans are, although the humans could all speak in this version. So maybe that's a change that happened because of the timeline issues in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Maybe the humans didn't devolve to the point where they couldn't speak anymore.
At some point, isn't somebody going to go fix that time hole?
Apparently not.
I mean, people keep falling through it. It's a health hazard.
We've got the standards. Zaius was back, but in a different actor, played Dr. Zaius in the TV show. Galen is the Roddy McDowell Cornelius / Caesar character, and this is another chimpanzee he's playing. And we even had a general in that, Urko. Urko was the villainous general in the series, and he looked exactly like Urkel, General Urkel. He looked like Ursus as well with the helmet and everything like that. So it's a little confusing, but essentially, and it was Peter and Alan, or whatever their names were, escaping from the ape, getting captured from the apes, and trying to survive on this crazy planet. I don't remember much of the series. I remember the basics of it. I remember having the two action figures, the Mego action figures, from them, the two characters. And I just thought that they looked like Starsky and Hutch for some reason.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Or $6 Million Man.
Well,
there was the two actors.
Yeah, they reminded me a lot of.
Very much Starsky and Hutch. Planet of the Apes versions of Starsky and Hutch. my favorite one was the ape that was convinced he could fly. And of course, he builds a rudimentary glider.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes down in the ocean. And so his proof drowns, you know, with him.
And that was Roddy McDowall, right? Throughout the whole series, that was Roddy McDowall.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Right.
Well, the whole series was what? How many episodes?
No, it was 13. Was it a full season? I thought it was a full season.
It was a full season. Yeah, it was a full season.
14 episodes.
And okay. a lot of expense in that. So it couldn't, you know, unless it was a huge hit, there's no way to sustain that. But the makeups and it was beyond what they could do.
But a lot of those shows back then, I mean, Logan's Run, I think, was one season, and Manimal was one season, and Phoenix was one season. I mean, they tried a lot of stuff back then that only lasted one season and then went away.
Those were 80s shows, weren't they?
All of them were, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever see, in original run, the Planet of the Apes cartoon?
Yes, I did.
I did. I watched it.
Yeah, I only caught one or two,
Return to the Planet of the Apes cartoon, Saturday morning cartoon, 1975, the very year after this was canceled. We've got, a series. So it was an animated series, and it is for kids.
More astronauts.
Oh, God. Jesus. Yeah, you're right. They do. They just do that same story over and over and over again, don't they?
They do. Yep. I want to give a quick nod here, and we skipped over her, and I'm so sad because she really helped to found my burgeoning sexuality as a heterosexual male. Would that be Linda Harrison?
We keep running into those.
Yeah, as yes, Nova. Absolutely. Nova. Oh my Nova. God.
Yep.
Yeah, that was a. Oh my gosh. When I watch it now, I'm just like, look at. Oh, yeah. If I had to start a the Earth again, all over again, Nova would be a great choice.
Absolutely.
It's a fantastic. All right. All
right. Keep it in your pants.
All right, in fact,
didn't Nova prove that she was the one that talked, right? She was the only other.
At the very end, she managed to say one word, and it was
Taylor.
And she died. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and that the originals, we'll love them forever. They play over and over and over again on television. But I must give credit where credit is due. These redos, the most recent ones, the new one is coming out, Battle for the Planet of the Apes. They are simply, in my opinion, amazing. They are fantastic on every level. Story, characters, performances, effects. I didn't know what to expect when the first one came out. And I finally went to see it without Blythe. I saw it. And I really enjoyed it. And then I was trying to get Blythe to see it. And she's like, no, I don't like those ape movies. No, I'm not interested. I don't want to see it. And finally got her to see it. And she very much enjoyed it as well. They have done, I mean, what a wonderful relaunch. That's an example of doing it exactly correctly.
Right.
And so I'm excited to see the new one. And I love the characterization of Caesar as done by Andy Serkis, and it's just, they're amazing. And again, and now to talk about all these issues that the original ones now refer to in our society, problems with mobs and mob mentality and religion mixing with science and all that, they can play with that in the new ones. I mean, beautifully. Working in the whole xenophobia streak that seems to be running through our culture and the tribalism and all that kind of stuff. Nice. I mean, what a perfect time to be making those movies is right now.
Those are the words I was looking for earlier, the xenophobia and tribalism. Thank you, Aaron. That hits it perfectly.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. They did a really interesting thing with the new series, starting with Rise of the Planet of the Apes, where it's truly a man-made phenomenon. In the original we know that Caesar came back in time via his parents and was born in our modern society as an intelligent, talking, evolved chimpanzee. Yep. In Rise of the Planet of the Apes, it's our science, our medical science, in order to combat Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. to create these apes, to give them intelligence and to work their brains and to cause them to be what will take over, what will conquer us. We've made our own problems. Unfortunately, the side effect to that drug, to that scientific experiment, is a virus that kills humans. So instead of the nuclear war of the original series, we have a biological one that we created and spread. Right. And I love the way that the original film ended with Caesar and his apes, who couldn't talk yet, who couldn't evolve yet, although some of them could, because he took the canisters and gave them all the intelligence. Of course, he had just started working his way up to talking. But anyway, him and his tribe escape, and then you see the airline pilot who's infected travel, and then you see the dots spread throughout the planet during the ending credits.
Was that not a brilliant way to show that? Yeah. All done with the end credits. I was genius. Oh my God, that's wonderful.
Super smart. There's some wonderful Easter eggs in the movie, which I like, that don't detract from the movie and pull me out of the film. One of the ones that we see is the rocket ship taking off on television, mm-hmm. Is the same rocket mission that mm-hmm. Taylor's on. And that's probably the most fun one, because it shows that this could absolutely be a part of the current continuity, mm-hmm. or it's its own thing. And I like to think of it as its own thing. I'm not the kind of person that feels the need to slot this into the old structure. I like seeing this kind of come up as it is, because honestly, there's a point at which, if you do it this way, there's a point at which the Weta stuff has to interact with the John W. Chambers stuff. And talk about shattering my suspension of disbelief.
Well, you can't blend the two together that way. But I mean, the story-wise, yeah. I like the other nods, like Bright Eyes being the name of one of the early apes. And that was, of course,
right.
what Zero used to call Taylor was Bright Eyes. The orangutan character being named Maurice is a nod to Maurice Evans, who plays Dr. Zaius in the original.
Yeah.
My favorite little original series nod was the character that Tom Felton played, Draco Malfoy. He played a character named Dodge Landon. And if you know the original, Dodge and Landon were the two astronauts that accompanied Taylor, and Dodge was shot dead, and Landon was trampled and later lobotomized.
Nice. I didn't even catch that. Wow. Yeah.
His name was Dodge Landon.
Yep. And he gets the line, he gets the line about it, the damn dirty ape, but it doesn't play the same way as when Michael Clark Duncan says it in the terrible movie. They specifically change it for the terrible movie, and in doing so make it more distracting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when Felton does it in this movie, it's a different context, but it's the same line differently.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds like I am splitting hairs and dancing on the head of a pin, but honest to God, if you compare the two movies, you know, it really is. It is a textbook on how to screw up a beloved franchise. There's an honest trailer version of the Burton Planet of the Apes. It's worth looking up because it really lays all this stuff bare. As for Felton's character, the Dodge Landon's a tough one, especially because he's one of the guys that you love to hate. He's still trading on Draco.
He's Draco Malfoy. Yeah.
So,
Kill that guy.
There's a great, somewhere on YouTube, there is the AFF, Austin Film Festival, did a series of interviews with various filmmakers and screenwriters and such. And there's a really good one with the two screenwriters. I think it's a husband and wife team. And they who did the remakes, this redo of Planet of the Apes. And it's so fascinating. It's definitely worth looking up and listening to their reactions is how they approached the material, what they absolutely didn't want to do, because there was a push at one point to make it much more of a parody, and insert a lot more humor in there. And then they wanted to make the apes like talk, and you know, how could we can't possibly do a movie with an ape that doesn't talk throughout the entire movie. That won't work. And so the battles they had to fight to keep that story the way, and it works beautifully the way they did it. I'm so glad they won those battles, but they had to fight. They had to fight. There's the usual push from various sources, and no, the apes have to talk, and no, let's put a lot more humor in there. You know, let's make it more for the kids. And they resisted all that. They wanted to have a really moving story about the young Caesar being raised by a human who he perceived as his father, how his isolation, how lonely he felt, how he felt he didn't fit in any world. He wasn't human. He wasn't an ape. And it's all captured wonderfully by Andy Serkis and his performance and the things that he does. There's one scene in particular where he's just been given to the sanctuary. Caesar draws the window. He draws the dormer style window of his attic, and he just sort of leans his head on it. And then when he realizes that they're not coming back for him, he just erases it. He just starts scrubbing it off this dirty wall. And just moments like that are all in the script. It's all in the script. And so
it's probably the most complicated of all the Apes movies, because you spend the first half of the movie siding with James Franco and Caesar's role in his life. You know, you want them to be happy together. You want them to be this sort of thing. And the point at which you realize that can't happen, you shift your alliance to Caesar, even as you know this is going to be the start of our downfall.
Right.
It's a complicated movie that moves you. It slides you down to where the apes are very naturally. I think it's one of the best pieces of filmmaking we've had in a long time.
I couldn't agree more.
Joseph, I found the terminology for you here, and I had to dig around a little bit for it. Performance capture acting. That's what Andy Serkis does. It's performance capture acting.
Yep. And it doesn't take anything away from him, in my opinion. He's still an amazing actor. He's fantastic. You know, he's going to be a great Claw in the Black Panther movie.
I'm so looking forward to that, because as appreciative as I am, and as amazed and blown away by his performance digitally, I always prefer him live.
You know, and I felt that as Snoke too. Quick sidebar: as Snoke in the new Star Wars series, Andy Serkis plays Snoke. I wish I would have just put him in makeup. There was no reason for him to be motion capture on that. I don't know. Anyway,
but regardless, in The Prestige, he was awesome.
Oh yeah, no, he's great. You know, he's a fantastic
actor. I just always love when he shows up.
I want people to realize that, you know, just because he's motion capture actor doesn't mean he's not acting. I mean, he's still acting. That's still him.
Oh,
he is
acting like crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So the next film in the series was Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which takes place several years, I think 10 years after the original, and the simian flu has pretty much killed most human beings on the planet, and we're starting to work towards our Planet of the Apes movie, a series where the apes are ruling and the men are not.
And by the way, just to give you a sense of how the times they have changed, Rise had a $93 million budget. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, $170 million. So they've doubled, but almost doubled the cost of the second movie, and rightfully so.
And the third movie is likely more than that.
Sure. Well, the third movie reminds me it's like Battlefield Planet of the Apes. I see a huge warring factor here for war, because we have the last remaining humans led by, I'm assuming, haven't seen the movie yet, hasn't been released yet. I'm assuming Woody Harrelson leads this band of humans, and they're going to war against the apes. But there are other apes in with the humans too. There are gorillas with Woody Harrelson's group. I see them in the trailers loading the machine guns and loading and the poster has got them, you know, in the crowd with Woody Harrelson's gang. So it's interesting because they have apes and humans versus apes.
Yeah. You know what I think? I think they've done a little bit of what we were discussing which was it, Escape? No, which was the one where the apes were turned into slaves in the original?
Conquest.
I think they've done some of that, where the humans have now started to specifically raise and train these intelligent apes to sort of be their servants, to help be muscle, to help be whatever it is that they need. So they've thrown that element in, which I find fascinating. I mean, because why wouldn't they? If there are now intelligent apes and you can raise them from young to think you're the good guy, you're on their side, why wouldn't you want a creature that can lift, you know, probably, 1,500 pounds over his head? So I find that element of it, Joseph, incredibly intriguing. And I want to see how they, because now then that's up to Caesar and his group of apes to convince these other apes, no, you've been lied to. You've been brainwashed. You have been programmed, you know.
Isn't it going to be a great moment, though, too, when that happens? Because let's face it, it's got to happen. There's got to be a moment where the gorilla on the bad human side is going to turn and just open up a can of gorilla whoop ass.
Yep.
You know, from within. That's going to be a nice moment.
But again, I just love how they're playing with these just wonderful. It is so topical right now as to who's the enemy, who do we fight, who do we not like. There are minorities on the sides of issues that you would not expect minorities to be on the side of, and there are other and there's all this mix, and it just shows that we are incredibly complex. We are not a simple species. And we have a variety of beliefs and ideals and fears, although a lot of them we share in common. But I think that is when it becomes dangerous, when you can turn the fears that we all have in common against each other. They're the bad guys. They're here to take your society. They're here to take your way of life. They're here to take your prosperity. And then we see enemies. We don't see a gorilla, doesn't see another gorilla. The gorilla sees an enemy. That's just brilliant. It's brilliant. I love these movies.
Speaking of brilliant, I don't think we could end anything else better than that, Aaron. Thank you so much. That was amazing. And we are unfortunately out of time. Maximilian's given us the red eye.
I know.
But wow, that was fun. And again, Aaron, that was a nice wrap up, sir.
Hats off.
Well done. The Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and written by Aaron Diarrive, Mark Finn, Mickey Finn, and Joseph Fotinos, with additional material provided by Dr. Maximus, the Lawgiver, and Dr. Will Rodman. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and the Gentleman Nerds nameless mascot created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, and our special guest bartender was Tracy the Gorilla. Our sound editor and accidental producer is Mickey Finn. Our executive producer and the man we all pray never gets superpowers is Aaron Diarrive. And Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hosting by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher Diarrive. Special makeup effects by John Chambers. And Tom Felton as Dodge Landon. Join us in the Lobot Lounge when next we meet. And please remember to tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. Final words, Aaron Diarrive.
Go see the new Planet of the Apes movies, folks. It's going to be great.
Mark Finn.
There's going to be a limited 3-play of that at select theaters, including mine, where we're going to watch all 3 back to back. And I cannot wait to have my brain melted.
And Mickey.
This is episode 42 of the Gentleman Nerd. Some of you may be wondering why we're talking about Planet of the Apes. That's because to Mark, the answer to life, the universe, and everything is all things simian.
This is true. This episode of Gentleman Nerds is lovingly dedicated to the actor synonymous with the Planet of the Apes series, Roddy McDowall. His voice was the voice of our favorite evolved apes, Cornelius, Caesar, and Galen. Thank you, Roddy. This is Joseph Fotinos reminding you all once again that Red Skull lives.
Caesar lived.
Yes, perfect. Caesar. Nice. Very nice. That's a good one.
I'm going to step away for a minute to use the facilities. I will be back.
Okay, excellent.
I'm going to do so as well. One thing I wasn't able to bring up in the actual podcast, I am actually not a huge fan of the first two of the modern films.
You're not?
Really?
I am exceedingly appreciative and impressed from a technical level, but they never get me on a visceral level.
Wow, interesting. Okay.
I suspect the third film is going to be different.
Oh, okay. Interesting, yeah. Well, cool.
I'm glad I saw the films. I'm glad they made them. They're just not for me, but I think the third film is going to be different. I think that one's going to grab me. I'm actually looking forward to it.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah, no, for me, I wouldn't have watched the second one and wouldn't be eager for the third one if the story of Caesar had not affected me the way it did. I mean, I think it's so well done. That first one is so well done. It is,
from a technical standpoint, from writing, from the visuals to the cinematography, everything was dead on. I think the problem in my corner, is that I've seen that type of story too much. And I'm like, well, I appreciate it. I appreciate what they did, but it's not, something wasn't getting me.
Well, it's also not a happy movie. You know what I mean? Like, there's not a happy ending. Well, yeah, it's a real.
And by the way, that's why Blythe didn't want to see it. Blythe thought it's going to be depressing. I don't want to see it. You know, they're going to mistreat Caesar, and you know, of course, everything that she feared was true, but she was so engaged by the character, the movie, the story but you're right. You don't walk away from it going, I feel uplifted. You know,
we finally saw, and as a sidebar, we finally saw Nightcrawler, and Nightcrawler. The reason we hadn't watched it was because we were told it was depressing. At the end, we're like, that's not depressing. It's not a happy ending, but it's not depressing.
Yeah, it's a cynical and a kind of an ugly movie, you know. But it's about ugly. It's about an ugly person.
Yes.
Okay, you're back,
which means
yes,
the bathroom's free. I'll be right back.
Yep. There's only one bathroom in the Lobot Lounge.
Yes. Actually, you know what? That's a good point. I will. I've been drinking coffee. I will go pee.